Hi, this is Joe Patty. Thanks for listening to WRTI Online. This service is made possible through the support of WRTI's members. You can become a member, too. Since you're already online, just visit www.wrti.org and click the Become a Member link on the upper left corner of the webpage. You can also join us by phone at 1-866-809-9784. Your membership will help keep WRTI's broadcast and online services strong. And again, thank you. Now, on with the show.
We have with us today someone who's become an icon here in Philadelphia, Peter Nero. Welcome, Peter, to Crossover.
It's so nice to see you again.
It's wonderful to see you and to be with you and to have you around. You are so, so busy, and the Pops has become really, I think, an entity because of you all over, I think, well, certainly the United States, in any case.
Well, we are growing so quickly now. We started off doing 8 concerts, then we went to 16 concerts, and now that we're at the Kimmel Center, we're up to 25 plus 10 holiday concerts. And those are non-subscriptions, so we're doing 35 concerts at Verizon Plus, conventions that we play, runouts. We do Trenton every year. We're starting a series at Westchester University, and that's for the community there.
Yes, and that's that whole the university has expanded enormously. They have a beautiful, beautiful facility there now, and they are really making a name as well in their music department.
Yeah, we just played there. And, of course, we're getting more and more into recording.
Well, I think people, of course, are always clamoring for tickets for the Pops, but they are officially called Peter Nero and the Philly Pops. Is that right?
That's correct. That's the trademark name.
That's the trademark name, and you are always there to not only kibitz with the audience, but to also play, which is something amazing. And I will certainly be showing my age if I say that I remember when you were just a solo artist many, many years ago, and you were a phenomenal success, and you had so, so many, many albums out, and you were really quite something. What made you come into this guise, actually, of conductor? It's not a guise. It is now what you are, conductor, performer, and to come to Philadelphia and to start all this.
Well, in answer to the first question, why I got into conducting, I'm going to quote from Andre Previn's book. He said he got into conducting out of self-defense. Now, I'm afraid that's the nature of the Pops world. At least it was back then in the 60s when I first started to play with orchestras. The players didn't take it very seriously, and rightfully so, because the music wasn't very challenging that was given to them. The main conductor wouldn't take it. He would always have an assistant or an associate or an Exxon Grand conductor. And very often it was lucky because he really was not capable of being able to handle the style of pop music. But most of the assistants were used to getting, instead of pop, pap. So when they looked at a score, they could sight read it and just get right through the rehearsal. When I came on the scene, I was doing things that were far more complex, and it really required some preparation. I would send ahead an album, and then I would send the score. And when we got to the rehearsal, I would discover that they really hadn't looked at it or listened to anything. So even though I brought my own rhythm section, it was it was a problem. And
but you were dealing with the top players wherever you went. I mean, because you were already a star. You had made quite a name.
But they need a leader up there. And so it was that was part of the problem, is that the conductors just either weren't interested or weren't capable.
Okay.
I think it was more of the not interested part.
Yes.
So at one point, I was a concert at Ambler here in the Philadelphia area with the Pittsburgh Symphony. It was their summer home at one time, amphitheater when it had burned down. And it would have been good. Neuro piano as well. Amphitheater Burns. Bad. Okay.
Okay.
We move ahead. Lehman Engel was the conductor for the night, and in rehearsal, he hurt his back. And he was going to be conducting my half, the second half. So he asked me if I would take over in performance my own half. Now, the only experience I had in conducting was conducting studio orchestras and my own stuff when we would be overdubbing. And that's when I got my trial by fire. I was kind of a little frightened because I'd never played with a major symphony orchestra before and conducted them besides. And I went to the concertmaster right after the rehearsal was over, and I had just, it was announced that I was going to be conducting. And I said to him, I'm kind of apprehensive about this. And he said, winked at me and said, don't worry, we'll take good care of you. And they did. So it was a nice way to break in.
Mm-hmm.
He did the Rhapsody in Blue and do that standard rep. But I finally got it the way I liked it. Now, it's always nice to collaborate with another conductor on that, because on that piece, as you know, the pianist is accompanying all the way until the very end. The rest of it, the only time the pianist is playing the melody is when it's a solo.
Right.
When it's a cadenza.
Right.
Other than that, it's just the orchestra's got the melody and the piano's accompanying.
Mm-hmm.
So, it's, as I say, it's very interesting to get somebody else's conception of it. But this time, I was able to do it my way, and that gave me this feeling that, well, maybe I could do the same thing with my own arrangements. And that's when I began to be submitted as pianist conductor. And the orchestra's always wanted to know, well, where else has he done this? So they mentioned Pittsburgh, and they mentioned Lehman Engel and so forth.
Who was a very respected conductor.
Yes, he was. Certainly. But, see, he came from the, even though his education was the traditional classical education, he still was noted as a Broadway conductor.
Yes, right.
That was kind of a stigma.
Yes.
As you know.
Yes.
So the Baltimore Symphony was Sergio Comisiona.
Yes. Oh, yes, I
who,
remember that.
My agent called me. He said, you got it in Baltimore. Sergio said it's okay. And he said, here's the way he put it. He said, anybody that can play the piano like that can conduct. Which I thought was really... he was sticking his neck out. And
you're doing, you went back to the Baroque style where you would sit at the harpsichord and then conduct, you know,
yeah,
so this is what you were doing.
I don't think they had a rhythm section in Baroque times.
No, I don't think so. You were the rhythm section in Baroque times.
I always bring a bass player and drummer with me who knows the book, and that mm-hmm. kind of holds it together so I concentrate. But when it comes to the rubato passages, I stand up and I conduct. And I wrote most of the arrangements with that in mind so that when... there were passages that the rhythm section didn't run the show that I could get up and conduct.
Well, I think just to go back a little bit again, back, you started out as a pianist. Did you? You started as a classical pianist? How you started?
Yeah, I started when I was 7.
Yeah, and you went through the whole 9 yards of training and so on.
Went to the High School of Music and Art.
And then went to Juilliard.
Went to Juilliard on Saturdays.
Mm-hmm.
And then
the prep department, yeah.
Studied privately, and the best teaching I ever had, and I think I mentioned this to you before, was Abram Chasins and Constance Keane from the time I was 17 till I was 22.
Uh-huh.
And Abram was here at Curtis for a while.
Yes.
And then Constance, his wife, was a great, great teacher. She worked with us once a week, and then we had a master class once a month with Abram. There were only five students.
So when did you veer off to Pops?
Well, I was actually a closet Pops player, because at home I would be, when I was supposed to be practicing scales and exercises and Czerny and Hannon and mm-hmm. Scarlatti, and then playing the Beethoven sonatas and so forth, suddenly I'd start in with the music of the day.
Right.
And my mother would yell off in the other room. She'd yell my name out,
mm-hmm.
the real one, Bernie, that's not what you're supposed to be doing. So, yes, mother, back to the exercise and so forth. But I was always enamored with the music of the day, which happened to be Boogie Woogie, which was the jazz form in that time. It was in the 40s.
Mm-hmm.
And then I really didn't get serious with it until I was about 15, when I started to pick off George Shearing records. And that was a treat, because I discovered all these fantastic harmonies and melodic lines, and, you know, it was all written down in books. And then whatever I didn't get, if I couldn't get the book, I could still pick off.
So you never really formally studied composing or orchestration?
Oh, yeah.
I
studied composing in college, but nothing with an orchestration. I studied privately. But no, not improvisation.
But, you know, when you came out, I mean, you were playing, okay, pop stuff, but you had a classical edge to you that made you stand out from the rest. I mean, you were something very special. I remember in the days when you made your tremendous hits with your recordings, you were different. There was something different about the way you played. You weren't just another, forgive this, jazz player or pop player. You had that classical edge. I think that's really one of the things that was very, very important that people remembered about you. I do believe that.
Well, interesting that you should say that, because I went through three phases. The first phase was the classical training, and then I did nothing but play in saloons and clubs, playing straight jazz. Mm-hmm. And I was learning.
Right.
So it was still really a classical pianist trying to play jazz. And I did that for 3 or 4 years, but no classical interpolations. There was no mixture of Bach and you know, quotes from Rachmaninoff.
Right.
It was just straight the bebop of the day. And it was about, it's about the third year when I started to get recognition from other jazz musicians who would drop in and who I respected. And I was beginning to get that feeling. However, at home, what I was doing was messing around with combining the two things, because the classical repertoire was still in my blood, and the feeling for jazz, you know, there was a lot of common ground between the two, but there were also a lot of disparities.
Mm-hmm. Of course.
So, in putting the two together, it was just for fun. I was just doing this at home. The most requested song I would get in the clubs was Somewhere Over the Rainbow. And right. I've played about 6 times a night. Uh-huh. And I got so tired of playing it that one day at home, I just started on it with an improv on it and played one chorus ad lib. You know, tempo ad lib, and then did the melody in tempo, jazz style, that rhythmic feeling. Mm-hmm. And then I went into a series of variations, starting off first with a Baroque style, not a whole chorus, just maybe 16 bars, and then did the bridge in Beethoven. Started moving up the line in terms of history, then went to Romantic style, Chopin, Liszt, etc. Mm-hmm. And then it got very melodramatic. This was all part of an improv at home. And I suddenly said to myself, if this gets any more melodramatic, we're going to wind up with the 1812 Overture. I said, well, why not? As this is all as I'm playing. Right. Mm-hmm. So left hand is playing, bum, 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 and the right hand is playing, bum, 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 bum. And it worked.
Oh,
it was consonant
enough. Superimposing them, yeah.
Yeah, you know, just putting them together and just the most ridiculous combination of two things you can think of.
But it wasn't, because you started something really with that. I mean, that really was, that was the time, I think, when, this was what, the 50s you're talking about now?
No, this, well, the contract
early
was signed
50s?
In 60 and recorded in 60. The first album was 61. So this was actually about 1959.
Yeah, the late 50s, which is, this is what happened. Music changed. The whole music world changed in any case. So here you are. You're a solo pianist. You're doing fantastically well. You're on television, you're on everything. I mean, your recordings are very, very successful. How did you when did you come to Philadelphia?
Well, I actually used to come to Philadelphia quite often. I used to play with my trio, played at the Academy. Mm-hmm. I played private dates for organizations, and I played with the Philadelphia Orchestra. Every once in a while, they'd have a Pops concert, you know, which they never really had much time for,
right,
but if
right.
it was an open service, they would have one. And they would either use somebody local or call in somebody from the outside. And Henry Mancini used to play with them. I even did an album with them. They were trying to start a Pops operation way back then. And I got the call, I think the first time was about 1975. Don't forget, I had done 2 albums with Leland and Boston Pops, so I was already qualifying.
And you were also in that vein. They thought of you in that.
Well, at that point, in 75, I was taking over on my own, so this way they could have a double threat mm-hmm. for a single price.
right. So you were playing with the Philadelphia Orchestra at that time, right?
In 1975, I played with them, and then I was called back to play again in 77. And it was at that time that impresario Mo Septi, who was running the All-Star Forum, got this idea. And he thought of, why can't we have a Pops Orchestra here in Philadelphia? And of course, he went to the Philadelphia Orchestra first, and they were maxed out on services. They had no room or time for doing Pops concerts. Very much like the Cleveland Symphony Cleveland Orchestra does not do Pops concerts.
Pops concerts, of course.
New York Philharmonic doesn't do that.
No.
And Boston, of course, the Boston
Fever,
Pops.
Yeah.
Well, we'll get to the Boston Pops in a minute.
Well, they had a kind of a separate, I mean, they had some people from the Boston Symphony, but I think it was like a separate orchestra, wasn't it?
I recorded with them in 63 and 65, they had every member of the Boston Symphony there, with the exception of the principals.
Really?
Yeah, that was the deal. There was no Esplanade Orchestra back then.
Okay.
It was the Boston Symphony. Yeah.
So they were really the forerunner.
As I say, just minus the principals. And you get that with a lot of symphony orchestras that I guest with. The principal has the option of not playing.
Okay.
And I've been very lucky, because a lot of them have opted to play.
because they respect you, I guess.
Well, it's mutual.
Yeah. So then here you were in Philadelphia. And again, one thing you just told me, which was rather interesting, is that the Pops is part of the Philadelphia Orchestra now for the last 2 years or so. Is that
right?
Yeah,
it goes back just a little over 2 years. We are presented by the Philadelphia Orchestra. We still have our own board, our own presenting organization, which is Encore Series, which signed an agreement with Philadelphia Orchestra to be presented by them. And what it really basically amounts to is what we call shared services.
Mm-hmm.
So we closed up our own office, and the people that we brought in have specific duties concomitant to the Pops only. And then there are the members of the staff of the Philadelphia Orchestra who, for instance, the marketing department, which is huge, has 15 people in it. Mm-hmm. We had one person. So they're all in on it. The PR department, bookkeeping, everything else to go along with providing the services.
But what was the reason that this happened? Was there a particular reason? Did they feel that they wanted to add you to their...
I think they found us to be, I'm picking up all this jargon from corporations, and one of the things they talk about is a brand.
I see.
So Peter Nero and the Philly Pops is a brand. I didn't know that was a brand. When I picture a brand, I picture a box of cereal up on the shelf.
Well, you've arrived, I think, being branded.
I'm branded. That's correct. So they felt that there was a large number of people who, within the structure of the organization, who wanted to have a Pops operation, but the orchestra is maxed out doing outreach programs and their own programs, so we are kind of taking all the load off of them. We are a separate orchestra altogether. There are a few Philadelphia Orchestra players that play with us because they want to, and they play on the same terms as the rest of the players. Mm-hmm. But basically, 95% of it is freelance players of Philadelphia. And even though we have 60 to 65 players on stage at one time, we will go through a pool of about 145 in the course of a year. And most of the rotation is in the strings, because the nature of freelance is that players can play any place they want.
Right.
So if they want to play the ballet or the opera and they get more services that way, and I say more power to them, because that way they can do as well as they possibly can. And also it gives us nice rotation so that people begin to learn the repertoire. And when they do switch around, they've played it before.
So they're a core group, pretty much.
Have a core group, mm-hmm, in there, which is basically a band. The steady people who don't play in the ballet and the opera are the trumpets, the trombones. Out of the reeds, I'd say we have about 10 players who we need 5, plus woodwinds. And the woodwind players, we have, it's kind of staggered, but basically most of the same people. And then, of course, a lot of strings are always there. But there are a lot who just can't make it. They also have careers of their own. We have string players who have careers and do solo concerts all over the world.
Well, freelance is kind of like that, too, I think, all over. You do have that. But you have your group that you call on. And of course, it sounds totally cohesive. I mean, every time, one hears you play. However, I wanted to, again, say you have different series that you do. Isn't that right? I mean, when you come on, what is your actual season?
Well, we start in either late September, early October, and we have 5 different series. And we have now gone to 5 performances of each series. We started out with 3, then we went to 4, and this year we're up at 5, because what happens is
the demand is very great.
Well, we're so close to being sold out that when we do a program that everybody wants to come to, there's no tickets left. So we decided to expand, and it's always the first couple of years is building, because then the audience does change. I'm finding that we're getting a lot of new people coming in.
Oh, I know. I know it's hard to get tickets to the Pops concerts. Very, very difficult. But again, what you have done is you've also expanded the concept of Pops, because you do some classical things as well, which used to be the Pops, classical Pops, I think, for the Pops orchestras. But then you do Broadway. You do special shows, like Christmas shows and so on and so forth.
Yeah, we're up to 10 holiday concerts now.
So now, tell us now, you're going to be, you are in progress right now with your concerts for the Christmas show, is that right?
Yeah, we just opened on Sunday, and we have 9 more to go, and we're in great shape.
Are there tickets available?
Yeah, there are tickets available, but I know last year we played for, oh, God, it was 20,000 people. Mm. So that tells you that there aren't really, you know, with the capacity of Kimmel, you divide that by 10, we're very close to sold out. A lot of concerts are already sold out.
And I'm sure there's a demand for recordings of your concerts. So tell us a little bit about what your plans are for recording. This Peter Nero and the Philly Pops Broadway Showstoppers is a fantastic album, I think.
Oh, I'm glad you like it.
Sounds terrific. Absolutely terrific.
Well, no, that was recorded live. And, you know, the Philadelphia Orchestra has done that. A lot of orchestras are doing that now.
Yes,
Rock and Rollers have been doing that for the longest time,
sure.
Where people leave the venue, usually an arena, and there's the record ready for them to buy. It's been recorded and it's being cut and pressed
as you speak.
Yeah, as we speak.
Were, yeah.
So we haven't gotten to that stage yet, but we got this out within a week, and at the next series we sold them in the lobby because people were commenting on this particular Broadway show saying that of all the Broadway shows, and this is what really worries me when people say this was the best one yet. Because I say, oh, my God.
What was going on before?
What did we do, and how are we going to top it on the next one?
Well, I have to say that this is the best one yet. It's really a wonderful album. And what I love very much is that there's a lot of you in it. So I think I've always been a fan, and I will continue to be. And I certainly admire you enormously for what you do and what you're bringing to the public and the scope of what you do as well, Peter. Now, Peter, what about the rest of the season that you have scheduled?
Following the holiday concerts, we have a concert called Fiesta Latino. And that is correct, by the way. Fiesta Latino.
Yes.
As opposed to Latina.
I had to
learn that the hard way in Florida.
I'll bet.
We had that concept down there. And we have been invited back after a five-year absence, and by popular demand, Nestor Torres, who was a marvelous Latin jazz flutist, but classically trained. When he comes back east, he lives in Miami. When he comes up north, I should say, he does master classes at Juilliard.
Yes, okay.
And fantastic technician, can play anything, a great Latin player and a jazz Latin player. And he has great arrangements that are written for him, and he was so sensational 5 years ago that last spring when I read the list of concepts and guest artists that we had for this coming season that we're in now, when I hit his name, there was this big rumble that went through the whole audience.
Mm.
So I know that they're all waiting for him to return, and I'm looking forward to it.
Now, when is this?
That will start in February. So I think it starts just the beginning of February.
And
first
how many
week.
Concerts are there?
Five.
And then what?
And then we're also throwing in Valentine's Day on the 14th, but it's just one concert only, of course, on Valentine's Day. And our guest on that will be Jack Jones.
Oh.
Who I'm really looking forward to working with again.
I know. I think you did. You told me at one point that you had worked with him.
We had worked together. And he had his own TV show for a while.
Yes.
It was up in, was done in Canada and syndicated in the United States. And I was lucky enough to be on the show that his father was his guest as well.
You know, I didn't say this before, but you had told me at one point, you were on an album with Rod Stewart, and you had told me that they needed somebody to play in the style. They couldn't find any, I guess, contemporary pianists that understood it. And they said, well, they contacted you. What was it that they needed you to play?
Well, Rod was had been rediscovered by Clive Davis,
right?
Who was the star maker. And he convinced Rod to go back to the old standards. And Rod's, you know, rock and roll singer.
Yes, of course.
And he, like Linda Ronstadt, took to it immediately. And the first album that they did sold 2 million domestically.
It was a phenomenal success. It was such a phenomenal success that it was unbelievable.
And he really sings it well. He's got that, you know, whatever quality in his voice, which is probably hoarseness from screaming his brains out all these years.
That's right.
To be honest, it's very sexy, and I know that the ladies love it, and his phrasing is really good, and the arrangements are really very simple, and it's hard to play that way because it's easy to, you know, fill up a minute or 10 seconds with a lot of notes, but to play sparsely and make some sense out of it, that was quite a challenge. But everything was pre-recorded. It was somebody else's voice that was on the track, It was a guitar and a bass.
But you had said that they tried the 24 pianists or something.
Oh, I don't know if it was that many, but there were a lot of pianists that come
that
in.
That just came in, and they couldn't cut it. It was not what they wanted.
See, Clive knew exactly what he wanted, but Clive, by his own admission, says, I really don't describe things in musical terms, so he'd use all kinds of metaphors. Mm-hmm. And they just picture Fred Astaire and Ginger Rogers, you know, floating across the dance floor, you know, dressed in white tie and tails, mm-hmm, and a gown and so forth. And you know what, how musicians are. Just, how do you want it? Loud, fast, slow, crescendo, diminuendo. Just, you know, tell me what you want. Yeah. And he had some name musicians in there, some name pianists, who after 10 minutes just got up and walked out because he told them, well, no jazz. But Clive knows how to make money. This is what he says to you. And he says, I know what sells and what doesn't sell, and I don't want any jazz. And I wasn't quite sure what he meant by that, because I listened to the first album and I heard things on there that had the jazz feel.
Right.
But I wouldn't, you know, call them out now jazz, more like, you know, cocktail jazz. So it was very difficult. But the engineer, Phil Ramone, who's been around the block a few times with recording artists, you know, let me know how many choices I had. And I spent 5 hours in there just on three songs.
But I think the fact that you were, you knew what to do. And
it took a long time to figure it out. See, because I would finish a take and I would think this is what he wants. And he would stop and he would discuss. Yeah, I see the discussion is going on in the control room. And then he would get on the PA and he would talk to me some more. And I gave them enough material. The way they edited it was very interesting, because they took like four bars at a time from different takes.
And they put it together.
Yeah, they really were, you know, he was very specific.
Basically, yeah.
And he's just going by instinct.
Really?
What he hears, what he thinks will sell. And he's right, because that second album also went, you know, gold, platinum, and everything else.
I know
there
it.
There are four now.
I remember. Have you done all of them?
No. No. I think I'm too expensive.
Too much of a good thing. So speaking of being expensive, what do we have to look forward to? I hope an array of recordings from the Philly Pops.
Yeah. The holiday concert we're doing now, we're recording. And that'll be ready for next year.
Mm-hmm.
But we intend to record, for instance, Nestor Torres, especially if he's going to do new material, we'll record that. We record everything. The question is whether we're going to use it or not. After that, we have Lucy Arnaz.
Oh, my. She's great.
Yeah, she was wonderful. She was doing the Florida circuit. And I was down there at the time last year. And I was invited to come see her. And the agent down there said, who we've dealt with before, said, I think she'd be perfect for you. So I went out and I watched the show and listened to her. And she really is good.
She's very talented.
She sings well. She looks good.
And she's a great actress, too.
And she engages the audience beautifully, yeah, and very relaxed up there. And she has some material in there that's some great songs that I had never heard before. And they're originals that she had, you know, come upon. And so we're really looking forward to working with her on that. The last one is called, I forget what it's called, because the concept is that it's based on music that the audience wants to hear. We do a survey.
Oh.
And it's broken down by composer, by genre, by your favorite song, your favorite instrumental piece. What instruments would you like to hear as, you know, soloists and so forth.
So
and
it's then an at-your-request kind of
thing.
Yeah,
it's by request. We've had different names for those kind of things. But what's really interesting is as we do this about every 3-4 years, and I can see the changes taking place and what people are looking for.
And what are they?
Well, now we're talking about a generation. Our demographics now have gone to between 45 and 65, and they used to be more like from 55 to 75.
You're getting
getting a younger audience, and yet the faithful that have been with us are still there.
Well, yes, that I know. But what is the trend that you see?
The trend is that it would be the music of their youth. So, for instance, we had a Motown concert in November, and we had a tremendous amount of single ticket sales for that, which is one of the reasons we went to 5 concerts, so that we can open up the doors for those who wanted to come to specific programs. And we always have big single ticket sales for Broadway, there's no doubt. But the Motown thing was really very surprising. And I was watching the audience. There was very little conducting for me to do on this one because the group was so self-contained, mm-hmm. and the orchestrations were always in tempo with what they were doing. So I was able to turn around and watch when they would do their moves and so forth. But the most fascinating part was to watch the audience singing along with everything they were mm-hmm. singing.
This happens in your concerts, by the way, because I've gone to them.
And
I've definitely found myself tapping.
Well, but they know all the words. And these are songs that, the Motown officially started in 59. And I officially started in 61. And Motown was on a roll all the mm-hmm. way through until 84. It was still very prevalent in the music industry, even though there were so many other things going on at the time. I really had very little to do with Motown. I wasn't recording any Motown tunes. Melodically, they're very simple.
To bring that into the concert hall is also something.
Well, we had Sha Na Na in there. Mm. The leader is a maniac. Mm. he was playing the keyboard there with his feet.
No, but how do you justify this?
Well, I'm not finished yet. Then he had wanted me to play piano. You know, this is right in the middle of the concert. That's fine with me. I'll leave the podium. I'll go play piano. So I sat down and I started to play one of the open spots, and you know, it was my turn for solo, and he picked up the mic and he's screaming my name out at the top of his lungs, and I'm getting carried away, and then I started playing the piano with my feet. You can't beat him, join him. So.
Well, obviously you can and you still can, which is again another thing that is really remarkable. Not that time goes by and musicians, I guess, get better with age, I think. So, I mean, as long as you can participate and be so very, very much involved and aware and bring to the public what you do, I think you really fill a niche because I only hear good things about Philly Pops, Peter Nero and the Philly Pops.
I am very lucky to have the caliber of musicians that I have there. They're a great bunch of people. And not only do they play well, but they enjoy what they're doing. And I get these comments from the audience, send me emails, letters saying that it's so nice to see an orchestra that looks like they're having a good time.
Well, you also make the audience have a good time. You have a kind of a dour, I guess they pronounce it, sense of humor. You know, you come out with a straight face and you say funny things.
Oh, man, I said something the other night. As I look out into the audience, I see many familiar faces out there. In other words, you've been here before. As a matter of fact, when I look into your faces, I see that many of your faces need looking into. And I don't know what possessed me to do that. Because the screen.
Because you're a ham, that's why.
Well, it's just, I figured, what have I got to lose? So, yeah. So you try something and if it bombs, you say, hey, I'm sorry, didn't mean anything by it.
I think, too, though, that you bring the audience in with you. That's really what you feel. It's warm. There's an accessibility that you bring with you to what you're doing. And that, of course, is a wonderful way to teach people as well. So what you're doing, if it's classical or Motown or if it's Broadway, they're part of it and they really do participate. And I think that's what you feel. And it's a special quality that you have.
I learned that from my piano teachers, Constance Keene and Abram Chasins, who taught me right from the beginning, you are not playing for yourself, you are not playing for the musicians on stage, you are playing for the people out there, and you have to communicate with them. That is your job as a musician. Everything you do on the piano, whether you're playing a short note or a long note, or you're making a crescendo, you're snapping the top of a run off so there's an accent on it, that's for the listener.
Well, communication is vital. And you're certainly communicating. And I love communicating with you, Peter Nero. Come back again.
Anytime. Just ask me. Thank you. It's nice to see you again.
Wonderful, dear.